Hi, South by Southwesters. This is Peter Broderick from Paradigm Consulting, and I'm glad to be on the line with Scott Kirzner, editor of the blog Cinematheque and author of the new book, Inventing the Movies. So, Scott, tell us about the sort of inspiration that led you to do the book in the first place and sort of what the kind of central theme of the book is.
Well, you know, I think the inspiration for it was really I've always been interested in new technologies and how they get introduced into the world, and often, you know, how people resist them and fight them kicking and screaming. And the more that I talked to people in the movie industry and started to write about Hollywood and independent filmmaking, it seemed like the perfect case study of how you've got these groups of people who are advocates for new technologies and developing them and promoting them, and you've got this other group of people that just don't want to change the way they do things. And so the book really wound up being a much bigger project than I thought. You know, it goes from the days of Thomas Edison in the 1890s to, you know, the current era of YouTube and the iPod and peer-to-peer file sharing. And, you know, the theme that kind of underlies everything is that whenever someone's introducing a new idea, whether it's a new business model or a new technology or, you know, a new creative idea, that there's a large number, you know, I would say the majority of people that kind of want to preserve the status quo, and they tend to battle that new idea.
Well, you show so many examples of that over the years and in so many different areas that it's a pretty pervasive pattern. When did you start working on the book, and how recently did you finish it?
I really started working on it, I think, at Sundance in 2005, and really just finished it, you know, this spring or early summer of 2008. And it was just a really fun process, both to look at the establishment and visit the Hollywood studios and talk to people who run those studios or people who produce movies for those studios, but then also to talk to people, you know, like Jonathan Coet, who made Tarnation, a great movie that played at Sundance. You know, he says the budget was $250 and it was made on his iMac. You know, the guys who were involved in Napoleon Dynamite. And, you know, one of the things that's so interesting about to me about the independent filmmakers at Sundance and at South by Southwest is that, you know, they're often at the vanguard. You know, they're the first people to see the potential of a new technology and start experimenting with it.
Well, when you think about sort of hierarchical power structures, the people on top think they have something to lose if things change, and the people at the bottom or, you know, outside the gate.
it's really true, right? They don't have anything to lose. They don't have anything to defend. They just want to make art and tell their stories, really.
Right. And I think, you know, from my standpoint, working with lots of independent filmmakers over the years, the sequence, and this is definitely demonstrated in your book, because your book talks about many things. It talks about big Hollywood, from the biggest, most legendary Hollywood characters and studios, you know, to the newest indies. But for the independent filmmakers, the changes that I've seen, and you talk a lot about this recent period, but they started out and they needed other people's resources to make a film. This was before digital cameras and software on computers that would allow them to edit and do special effects. And then when digital technologies came in, for the first time, they could own the means of production and the means of post-production. So nobody could stop them from making a movie. But still, they had to get the permission and resources of third parties to distribute the film. And as you show at the end of the book, with the coming of digital distribution, now filmmakers have figured out ways to do distribution, you know, without conventional distribution. So nobody can stop them from making a movie, and nobody can stop them from bringing a movie into the world.
Yeah, you know, the Francis Ford Coppola quote when I talked to him for the book was, he said, "Cinema's escaping being controlled by the financier, and that's a wonderful thing. You don't have to go hat in hand to some film distributor and say, 'Please, will you let me make a movie?'" You know, so I think you're right. You know, we saw the democratization of production really over the last 10, 15, 20 years. And right now you're seeing the democratization of distribution in a really powerful way, whether filmmakers want to sell DVDs or whether they want to sell downloads.
Well, you know, it's interesting. Each of the different chapters, you know, you give examples of this conflict between people interested in innovation, and you call them preservationists. I find that a very gentle term for people who are fighting tooth and nail against innovation.
Would you call them, like, meatheads?
Well, the people looking backwards who can tell you how things have always been done.
Yeah.
They're
definitely traditionalists. They're conservatives. I mean, preservationist was the term that I kind of landed on just because, you know, what I see them doing most often is trying to preserve the status quo, you know, whether that's a business model that they're really comfortable with, like, you know, Hollywood studios still prefer to sell DVDs and Blu-ray DVDs than to sell you a movie on iTunes, you know, or it's preserving cutting movies on film or shooting movies on film or some other kind of tool or, you know, existing process that they don't want to have go away.
Well, in each different chapter, you have another set of folks that think they have something to lose. So when you talk about digital editing, there's the, you know, old guard editors who just edit on film their whole lives, and then all of a sudden there's this nonlinear scary thing that happens. And
you know, one of the most incredible quotes to me was, you know, Stephen Cohen was one of the first editors in Hollywood to really start using the Avid system and kind of to help Avid break into Hollywood. And he even told me, you know, he said, the thing that's unfortunate now that you have Avid and you have Final Cut Pro is that everyone can get lots of experience editing when they're in their teens and their 20s, and suddenly you have people competing with us for jobs who are much younger than ever before. You know, in the old world, you really had to apprentice with an existing editor, you know, and just to try to get time on the machine and see how they used it. And now, you know, you can spend your teens and your college years apprenticing, you know, over your laptop, and suddenly you become a pretty good editor.
And there are also all the other reasons that the old line editors resisted, the idea that somebody could look over their shoulder more easily, which you talk about, that, you know, in the old movieola days, you know, it was sort of a tiny screen that the editor could kind of monopolize.
The idea
that directors can say, no, let's try it 100 different ways, and
right,
you have to put up with that.
And it's funny because a lot of old school cinematographers said the same thing about the video tap and having video monitors on the set, because before it was really just the cinematographer that looked through,
right,
you know, through the viewfinder and said, yeah, that was a great take. And everyone sort of took their word for it, or at least until dailies, you know, the dailies showed up. And now you have this monitor where it's like the producer's girlfriend is sitting there saying, no, I think, you know, her dress is too wrinkly in that take. You know, you need to do it again. And the cinematographers don't like that.
Well, I remember in the late 90s when I was at Canon 98 when the Celebration and the Idiots were there. And that was the beginning of Dogma 95 and the idea that you could shoot a movie on a camera that was designed to take pictures of babies' first steps and show them on the living room television. And so you had this tremendous resistance, not just from Kodak, but from, you know, experienced cinematographers, about shooting digitally and degrading the image and, you know, the end of cinema as we know it. And the other great holdouts at that time period were film professors.
And why do you think why were they holding out?
Well, I mean, I think it just comes down to, you know, they have a certain expertise, just like the cinematographers, and they were afraid that if movies were being made a different way, that was undercutting their expertise, and there could be, you know, new experts coming along who understood things that they didn't know.
Yeah.
Tell me about the role of indies. I mean, it seems that, you know, the biggest and baddest independent of them all, George Lucas, was a force for change, you know, on so many fronts, special effects, you know, editing, you know, digital production. Do you think that he was the force in many ways that pushed things along?
I do think he helped push a lot of things along. You know, it's kind of a mixed bag because, you know, he's kind of seen almost as a real outsider and someone who always has kind of done his own thing. And so, you know, he isn't in Hollywood. He's not there kind of mixing it up day after day. And so I think maybe he hasn't been able to nudge people as hard or as quickly as he wanted to. You know, nonlinear editing took much longer than he wanted it to. Digital cinematography still hasn't, you know, hasn't taken over, and that's something he's been working on for about 10 years now. You know, so I do think there's some frustration there that, you know, even though he's willing to experiment with stuff and you know, put quite a lot of money behind it and use digital cameras, you know, and digital projectors on his Star Wars movies, you know, it hasn't quite, you know, it hasn't quite taken off as quickly as he'd want. But, you know, he was very, you know, by hooking up with, say, the folks at Texas Instruments or the folks at Sony Electronics who, you know, who introduced kind of some of the first 24 frame a second digital cameras, you know, he really helped those companies kind of break into the movie industry.
So, okay, so looking, now that you've, you know, put all this together for us and helped us understand the sort of patterns and the secrets, when you look at this moment in time forward, where do you see the most exciting opportunities for independent filmmakers?
Well, you know, one is in the area that you really focus on, which is kind of the avenues of distribution. And it's, you know, it's really exciting to be able to me, to be able to sell DVDs on demand and not have, you know, not have to, you know, burn 1,000 or 5,000 of your own DVDs and fulfill orders. And, you know, so to sell through things like Amazon's CreateSpace subsidiary, to sell digital downloads. I mean, I think iTunes is slowly opening up to more independent filmmakers, although they've been really way too too slow on that, in my opinion. So, you know, avenues of distribution are creating opportunities, and I also think that the ways that people are watching video and the kinds of video that they want to watch are creating new creative opportunities. And I think that that's been, you know, not really well understood. I mean, filmmakers want to keep making 90-minute long or, you know, 100-minute long feature films, and yet the audience behavior now on the internet is watching things that are 3 minutes long and 5 minutes long and maybe, if you're lucky, 10 minutes long. And, you know, I look at stuff like Dr. Horrible's sing-along blog, the Joss Whedon series that came out this year, as really important experiments in saying, can you do creative stuff? Can you do fun, high-quality storytelling in a, you know, 7 or 8 minute format, you know, and can you use the internet to distribute it? I just don't see enough people working to sort of figure out what the new forms and the new genres are going to be. But I'd be curious, you know, I'd be curious to hear your take on those two things, because, you know, I know that you think about them both a lot too.
Well, I mean, I think there's some interesting examples. Robert Greenwald made 4 hour to 90 minute documentaries in a row, all of which were successful. And then after A Rock for Sale, he tells me, okay, Peter, I'm done with that. Now I'm going to make things that are, you know, 3 to 5 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, if you go to the Brave New Films website and look at the, you know, the latest John McCain video, I think it's had, I don't know, 7 or 8 million views.
Mm-hmm.
And it's 5 minutes long. And if it, you know, it had been feature length, I'm sure it would have been a fraction of that. So he has the capacity with his team to make something that's that short, put it on the web, go out virally, and get it kind of instant distribution and an instant response and an instant impact on the, you know, on the campaign.
I guess I want to, before we run out of time, I want to ask you one last thing, which is, there were some interesting discussions at the filmmaker conference last week, and, you know, almost at every festival and film conference you go to, about windowing. And, you know, in particular, I was kind of going back and forth with Tom Bernard from Sony Pictures Classics about, you know, look, a lot of times when a movie plays at a festival, that's the most attention and publicity it's ever going to get in the life of the movie, whether it gets picked up for distribution or not sometimes. You know, why not release the movie during the festival or the week after the festival, at least in some way that, like, interested people, you know, if you have friends who go to Sundance and they tell you, hey, I just saw this great movie, or friends who go to South by Southwest, and what are you supposed to do to act on that? Well, you're supposed to wait 6 or 9 months until someone picks it up for distribution and decides to release it and puts it in a theater, and then you wait another year if you want to watch it on your iPod or on DVD. I'm curious what you think about the idea that, you know, that windows aren't really serving us anymore in this kind of instant gratification world that we live in.
A number of filmmakers that I've been working with have started selling DVDs at film festivals, and that's, you know, that would be a, you know, a mortal sin from the standpoint of conventional distributors, you know, as of, you know, probably a few months ago and maybe
mm-hmm.
even today. But they're saying, you know, we've shown the film to an audience. There's a Q&A. People are, you know, have really responded to the movie. They have an opportunity to buy it then and, you know, have a copy of to keep or to, you know, give to somebody else as a gift who wasn't able to come to the screening. There's an immediacy to that that, you know, if filmmakers can take advantage of it. Then there are festivals, and Cinequest has been one of the leaders of this, that have made their films available online at the same time that they've been in festivals. So I think, you know, I think festivals are exploring that. And as you know better than anybody, for traveling to all the festivals where you moderate panels and to other things, you know, there's a limited number of people who have the resources and are geographically, whatever, available to get to specific festivals, and then there's the rest of the world. And I think that festivals are going to need to reinvent themselves in part so that they can have an audience that's broader than the people that can show up at one, you know, 1 week in Salt Lake City or Park City or wherever it is. And so I think that the festivals do create a unique opportunity. And then as theatrical has gotten harder, and more dismal, the role of festivals in creating awareness, you know, has become more important.
You know, to plug South by Southwest a little bit, I mean, what's so interesting about that particular festival is that it happens alongside this interactive conference, you know, so that you have the sort of filmmakers and the techies and the internet people all in one place. And so I think that turns into a really interesting petri dish, you know, that's quite different from most other film festivals.
I agree. And my old friend Janet Pearson is now running the festival. And I think that I'm sure that the festival is going to be doing great new things under Janet. So let's go back to Inventing the Movies by Scott Kersner. Scott, it's available in many ways. So why don't you kind of run through how people can get it?
You know, the most convenient way might be Amazon.com. It's also on Lulu.com. And there's a whole bunch of material that isn't in the book and some audio and video material at the book's website, which is scottkersner.com, KIRSNER.com/inventing.
Well, it's great talking with you, Scott.
Yeah, thanks for doing it.
Thanks for doing this.